Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today on the show, we have Reverend Dr. Gary Dorian, the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. Dr. Dorian is here with us today to discuss his 2015 book published by Yale University Press called The New Abolition, W.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel. Welcome to the show, Reverend Dr. Gary Dorian.
Thanks, Adam. It's a delight to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on to the show. It's definitely a pleasure and an honor, especially, you know, with this being the 150th year, as we talked about offline, of W.E.B. Du Bois' birth. And so, especially me right now being in a place in Massachusetts, in Boston, where it's snowing. So it's a prototypical, you know, New England day, right, in the spring.
It's ridiculous.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And so before we get knee deep into this phenomenal work, can you tell us about your trajectory to how you got to your position right now at Union and also Columbia University?
Oh, sure. Well, I grew up in a semi-rural, lower-class neighborhood in the middle of Michigan. My father and my parents had grown up in the Upper Peninsula. My father took a fair amount of abuse for his being Native American. And when he moved to mid-Michigan at the age of 20, he considered that an opportunity to get all the white privilege he could get going on his side. So, and especially to raise his children, he wanted, that was the most loving thing he could imagine doing, is to raise them in a way that they wouldn't have to deal with the kind of things that he grew up with. And so I grew up, it's just sort of culturally, you know, white as far as I knew, and certainly in this very sort of deeply sort of lower class white semi-rural community in Michigan. So that's what I came from. It was only, I mean, many, many years later, you know, my father, you know, had a kind of personal adjustment. I mean, today he is vigorously, even aggressively Native American. And that would not have happened without the Civil Rights Movement. I grew up in the, you know, the lower class of a very white world, and was lucky to be able, you know, to go to college or anything like that. I mean, where I grew up, nobody talked about, you know, going to college or having a career or any such thing. So my whole life is fairly unlikely in that respect. I did squeak into college. I had Martin Luther King was a luminous figure in my imagination and my life through school. He was assassinated when I was in high school. He was to me, to the extent that I even had thoughts about religion or politics or such things or just anything sort of transcending the life world of a lower class community. I mean, it was because of King, and also because of the imprint of just enough of kind of Catholic sacramentalism, of the Catholic iconography, especially Jesus on the cross. We were not religious people. I was not very churched, but I got just enough of it to be affected by it. And then this one thing and another kind of blended together in my thought and feeling with Martin Luther King and this cross story. And that's what ended up taking me into, you know, years later, actually joining a church and going to seminary and getting all these degrees that took me in this path. But I didn't become an academic till I was 35. I came in through the door of social justice activism, solidarity activism. In my 20s, I was a speaker for two Latin American solidarity organizations, and was deeply involved in community organizing and in the anti-apartheid movement. And it was only at the end of that period that I actually, you know, joined a church and started on this track of where I was a pastor for some years in the Episcopal Church. And then when I was 35 years old, I stopped repressing this academic whatever. and I had three books out by then. And my wife, who was a fabulous Presbyterian minister, a much better pastor than I was, just said, look at you. You know, you're writing these books at 3 a.m. That should be telling you something, you know, about who you really are. So why are you repressing it? So that's what finally got me on an academic path of teaching and live and just having the wonderful privilege of being an academic.
Right. And I think that, and as I told you offline, I had the great opportunity to listen to some of your book talks on this one, and also the second part of this group of books that you're coming out with, that you've come out with as well. I've had the opportunity to hear you talk about this particular story. So can you tell us about how and why you came to this particular subject of the Black social gospel? Because it's something that I think has affected the world greatly. And yet I don't think people can actually articulate fully where this, you know, Black social gospel movement comes from.
Yes. Well, firstly, as I said, I came in through the door of social justice activism. So that's what I really am. And a lot of that was involved in community organizing. During my years as a pastor, I organized, you know, ecumenical MLK services. So that's my work. And so, of course, that's what I brought to my scholarship. In fact, the scholarship really was just an aspect of the solidarity activism that I was doing. It wasn't the other way around by any means. And so I guess four of my first five books were all about democratic socialism or social democracy or aspects of religious socialism, liberation theology, and the like. I had one Kant and Hegel book that was just pure philosophy in those early books, but most of the others had something to do with these topics. So I came actually quite early to a reading on what the social gospel movement had been that was contrary to what was in the literature. I mean, there's this famous white social gospel movement that there are shelves and shelves of books written about, and I was influenced by it. I mean, Walter Rauschenbusch, the great figure of the white social gospel, is a tremendously important figure to me. So I was, you know, very conversant with that literature and wrote a fair amount about it. But the fact that so much of that literature, virtually all of it, is just such a white bread phenomenon, you wouldn't even know that there was such a thing as a Black social gospel going on at the very same time, and which in many respects is better than this white social gospel movement and dealing with real issues that only certain white social gospelers even get close to. And so I had a certain sort of dissatisfaction and just sort of contrary feeling about, you know, how this subject should be talked about for a very long time. And I did sprinkle it into various books along the way. I mean, at least four or five of my books, I've got 18 books out there, and a number of them have parts of my argument about this Black social gospel in them all along. But meanwhile, this is years after, you know, I've finally come to Union in Columbia. I'm trying to get someone else to write this big, you know, Black social gospel story, because I'm, you know, here I am teaching that this, it's so important, and I've got it, pieces of it in various books. But, you know, my argument is that we need a major work on this extraordinarily important tradition that just almost never gets named as a tradition as such, And so therefore, certain people have just been forgotten who should not have been forgotten, and we need to get back. And it helps us understand Martin Luther King anyway. You don't really get King if you don't get, you know, what he's coming out of. So I've got all these arguments and thinking I'm going to persuade somebody out on the lecture circuit or one of my own students to do it. And it never happens. And meanwhile, I've got friends here at Union, like especially my dear friend James Cohn, who, you know, just said, Gary, it's your obsession. You know, why don't you just do it? You know, you're the one who's got all this in your head. And I did realize, I mean, there came a point when I realized, yeah, this isn't something I can be laying on younger scholars. The kind of book I've got in mind is something that requires years and years of, you know, of being involved in a subject such that you can generalize about, you know, you can make that statement about what's been said and what hasn't been said and the like, because you've in fact read everything. And that's the kind of book that you can't just, you know, you can't come out early in your career, write a book of that sort. So even that was a factor to sort of get me over this hurdle and say, you know, okay, I'll just face up to doing it myself. And of course, once I got going in it, it was almost as a relief for me to just finally just completely give myself to this large subject, because the book registers a certain depth of feeling that I have about it, and also just trying to get the rest of the field to tell this story rightly, because the better social gospel is the one that doesn't even have very much literature.
Right. And that's why I think that your book is so important, because, you know, as you mentioned that, you know, other younger scholars specifically that you're kind of initially pushing towards this project or this kind of project, you know, this is a huge undertaking, right? This is a huge undertaking. So not to say, of course, that younger scholars didn't have the opportunity or couldn't have made a good attempt. But personally, I am not too mad that Gary Dorian have taken the mantle with the push of liberation theologian James Combe as well, pushing to say, hey, man, this is your project and we want you to do it. So we're definitely appreciative of that work. Right. And so, so that's why getting into the book, because, you know, I found it very remarkable. You know, when I read, I mentioned to you offline, I went to see, went to present a couple papers at the University of Memphis, and I came into contact with, was it a Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson, right, at the University of Memphis. And I didn't really have a big conversation with him, but became a Facebook friend, and I realized, like, oh snap, this dude is like, he's really out here doing the work. And so, and, you know, and continuing that tradition, and you know, every Sunday he always asks, you know, can I pray for you, which is always a beautiful thing to see as well. So, you know, seeing his work and seeing your work and the work of, I think he's doing a project with Henry Turner, right? And so, you know, can you talk about really the foundational persons to the Black social gospel, the ones that obviously by century, almost this full century predate King?
Yes, well, certainly. My argument about the founders and just the founding of the tradition itself is that it's a new abolition movement. Here we have these founders are people, some of whom have lived through the abolition period. They were abolitionists, and then the Civil War, and then Reconstruction now has even come and gone. And now they're having to ask the terrible question in the late 1870s, early 1880s, well, what would a new abolition be now? You know, what does it need to be now? Which is a terrible question, especially if you've lived through all the drama and trauma of what abolitionism itself was. You're highly aware, because you're right in the middle of it, that you can't just kind of recycle what you said before. This is a different situation. It's a different moment. And in some ways, I mean, this is every bit as terrible or worse and terrifying as what you were dealing with before, because now you've got this mania of lynching going on, and these 14th and 15th Amendments that were struggled so hard for are now being, you know, ripped away through much of the country. And so needing to kind of rethink, how do we preach the faith? How do we think about it? What kinds of organizations do we need in this context? That is the sort of orienting question. And people like Henry McNeil Turner and William Simmons are people who do bridge these two things. They were abolitionists, you know, in that earlier time, and they're old enough to have gone through all that. And then they're deeply involved in Reconstruction politics and religion. They sort of symbolize the sort of coming together of those two things in Southern contexts. And then Reconstruction is ended, sabotaged, I would say. And now they have to, sort of think about what now, what kind of organizations, how do you think about the faith, what kind of social Christianity speaks to this situation, and including just what do we need to do within the churches themselves. How do we convince church people they need to be involved in social justice politics? That alone, just that aspect of what it means to be social gospel, that you're telling ordinary church people who've come to church on Sundays, a kind of refuge from a hostile world, and many of them just, you know, want to sing and pray and focus on heaven and on Jesus, and having to say to them, no, the church has a social mission to transform the structures of society in the direction of something called social justice. You know, each part of that note, there are three parts of that sentence, and none of them are possible before the social gospel generation, because you need sociology and social consciousness and all that social stuff that comes from that period. That part of the story is similar in the white church and black church contexts. But of course, in the black church context, there's a struggle for life and death. I mean, everything's on the line here. And the social gospel cannot just get you in trouble with your religious colleagues the way it can in the white social gospel. This can get you killed. So it's a terrible thing to have to take on. In all of my founding figures, with one exception, in the New Abolition, there's only one exception to this. All of them have some kind of battle with their own denomination, because the social gospel is controversial. It is pressing a demand that many people don't want. And even, you know, in the AME, you got bishops who don't want to be involved in this kind of activism. So that debate is just perennial. It's just a given. And that, of course, didn't end with the founders. And Martin Luther King had to deal with that. The founding generation is people like Turner, who was a bishop, and William Simmons, a similar kind of figure in the Baptist context, has spent most of his career in Louisville, who bridge the two generations, who live, who are sort of founders of a new movement and helping to build new organizations, and for whom they and then others around them. Some of them are only truly recovered when you sort of ask this question: well, if there was a black social gospel, then who was in it? How many people are we talking about? What did they do? What did they build? And the like.
Right, and trying to really see about really the foundational elements of it, and also thinking about people you mentioned. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, but also someone that I've come across personally in my work, dealing with late 19th century black women's print culture, being William Simmons, and how influential he was to women like Ida B. Wells, who you mentioned in this book, who I think seeing, you know, the women that are involved in this, and this tradition too, I thought was very intriguing and something that I think is a valuable addition, because I think sometimes, maybe not even sometimes, but a lot of times, the influences and the central words and interpretations of women, Black women in this tradition as well, really social activism gets really thrown under the rug. So it was definitely awesome to see someone like William Simmons, who gives opportunities to people like Ida B. Wells and other women to be able to speak boldly within the confines of newspapers.
That's right. Both Turner and Simmons, were feminists so far as access and rights and lifting up women and regarding and wanting women to play public roles. In fact, Wells couldn't count very many of just supporters who definitely had her back. And of course, she's doing exceedingly dangerous work because she is the anti-lynching crusader in this country. And she can only do that in certain parts of the country. But having somebody have her back, and Turner is one of the few that she absolutely can rely on. He's just a rock because he is utterly fearless and brave in a way that's just almost impossible to comprehend. Wells is a major figure for me in the new abolition, as is Nanny Burrows, as are the club women as well. I mean, that's a different trajectory, and that's more of the elevationist tradition with some of them. And of course, Wells was even in that. I mean, she was in the club movement herself, although they didn't elect her to leadership positions because they admired her, but they didn't really need her as an officer in the organization. But a person of just unbelievable bravery and eloquence and importance. Now, Ida Wells is someone that recovered by the early women's movement and the Black Power movement. I mean, that she was forgotten for decades. In fact, her autobiography went unpublished for 40 years. First, she lived to see herself forgotten. You know, she lived long enough and lived through the 1920s, seeing people write books and giving speeches about lynching that never mention her somehow. Just unbelievable. And so she writes this extraordinary autobiography at the end of her life just to kind of, remind people of what she did and where this whole lynching movement, anti-lynching movement came from. And then that book went unpublished for 40 years, despite a loving, determined daughter who worked assiduously to try to get it published. And it's only because of, the women's movement and Black Power movements coming up, at the same time, sort of looking back for, who have we lost, that Ida Wells, of course, was recovered in that work. So people like Paula Giddings did important work on her. But she's very much in this Black social gospel story, since most of her activism is going on, in social gospel contexts and churches, where she's trying to, get ministers to kind of stir up their courage to do this kind of work, or at least to support her in it, and to build an organization and the like. So Simmons and Turner are both figures of an earlier generation who admired her and supported her and who did an enormously important sort of foundational work. They're social gospelers of different kinds, to be sure. I mean, Turner is just the epitome of the Black nationalist tradition within this Black social gospel story. And Simmons straddles some of these lines. I mean, there's a nationalist streak in Simmons, but always, he can work with white Baptists, and he's good at saying we need to cross lines. We don't want to just stick with a nationalist line. And being involved in social justice politics means you got to do coalition politics, where you're working with people who don't look like you or, exactly like you, but you need to, pull together to achieve ends. So there are differences between these two giant foundational figures who come before the others, you know, sort of in my story. But they, what they have in common is just this extraordinary bravery and a kind of liberation theology a century before, you know, this term exists, a liberationist way of understanding the scriptural narrative and the social ethical meaning of the faith, and that if Christianity means anything in a North American context, it's got to speak to the aftermath of 246 years of chattel slavery and now this Jim Crow plague.
Right, absolutely. And you know, I think all this is going on. There's, you know, I heard recently Ibram X. Kendi, a scholar at American University, talk about how, you know, how sometimes people mention, you know, we go two steps forward and one step back, right? Especially in this context of a Trump presidency. But one thing that Dr. Kendi mentions is that that's never true. That yes, you abolish slavery, but there's the foundations for how the failed nature of certain areas of Reconstruction can happen. They were always there, even at the win, right? Even at the win of emancipation. And so when people mention that all, you know, two steps forward, one step back, you know, that's a mischaracterization of history. That's a mischaracterization of how historical processes work and how it's only inevitable because we can see it in the timeline. But what about for the people who are actually living in those particular times? They have no earthly idea of what is going, they might speak into existence within the prophetic tradition, but as far as them literally being able to pick out the certain area of history that's going to happen, you know, that's definitely not something that folks within this particular tradition would have been able to go for. And I mentioned that because, you know, someone who, you know, whose name is in the title of your book and who people, you know, who feel like they know Du Bois greatly will probably look at your title and be like, Black social gospel, but I thought I thought Du Bois was anything but, you know, someone who, you know, what came from a monotheistic background or actually not, maybe not came from it, but who expressed those kinds of religious ideals. But I think you have some fodder for folks who might think that. So if you could speak on that particular area, if you can.
Oh yes. Well, firstly, I would say that you know, I identify sort of four lines of the Black social gospel. There is a Booker T tradition. I mean, that is part of it. A lot of those ministers for whom Booker T had it right. And there is a nationalist tradition, and there is a protest politics tradition that ends up clustering around Du Bois, and that he represents better than anyone else, even though, of course, he is not a Black social gospeler per se. And then there's a group that kind of tries to have it both ways. It's sort of a, you know, there's a Booker T trajectory. There's aspects of Booker T's witness and what he's doing, including even the nationalism that's in Booker T, that are right. But then Booker T's definitely wrong about, you know, we don't do protest activism. No, we've got to do that. So there's also that both and group that's kind of having it both ways. So I sort of identify these four traditions of the Black social gospel in these first couple of generations. And all four of them already exist before Du Bois comes forward. I mean, before Du Bois sort of breaks out and then sort of takes on Washington. And then once that happens, once you have a Du Bois versus Booker T argument that is just so orienting and electrifying and that frames so much, well, then that's, you know, that's the central thing I'm tracking for a while. But of course, Du Bois himself, he came from somewhere, and he, in that late 1890s, early 20th century period, he has, you know, a dream for the Black social gospel. He's very, very much aware of his clerical followers. I mean, he has at the second Niagara Conference. He had Reverdy Ransom, well, you know, gave the gave, you know, what was really the electrifying address of that conference. And Richard Wright Jr. and other clerics are involved in Du Bois's organizations, and he is assiduous in making sure that he's got, you know, folks like that. He and Reverdy Ransom work together in a number of things. So he is the sort of leading force in that the protest politics version, a tradition of these four. And so people like Ransom and Wright and others, Adam Clayton Powell Sr., you know, look to him for a certain kind of intellectual leadership and inspiration and guidance. And they take, you know, they thrill to read him in Crisis. All of them understanding that Du Bois is not, you know, he's not a churchgoer. He's not someone who's a creedal Christian or anything of that sort. And there are all manner of debates about, you know, what do we make of whatever sort of religious sensibility that is there with Du Bois. I make the argument that Du Bois is purposely elusive and sort of double-minded about this religion issue. He's certainly not a churchgoer. Or the like, and yet this tradition that I'm writing about, these Black social gospel ministers and others, are very important to them. He certainly sees himself in being involved in that struggle. He wants the social gospel way of understanding the faith to prevail in the churches. He thinks there's too much otherworldly, you know, Christianity going on in the churches. So he's, you know, he's cheering for Turner and Ransom and Wright and these people all along and working with them, and he's just such a transcendent figure in the politics of the time, such that even though I just have to sort of take the risk that people are just going to read the title and think that I'm saying that W.B. Du Bois was a Black social gospel something, and you know, that is not what I'm saying, but he is the crucial figure in that. Certainly second generation story of what was the Black social gospel tradition. And that's then the line that does take you to Martin Luther King is the one that he represents better than anybody other than maybe Reverdy Ransom.
Right. And you know, going back to even the souls of Black folks, you know, soul of Black folk, you know, you talk about how you know, he spoke largely about the sorrow songs and he talked about the importance of those when it came to the religiosity of African Americans. And obviously they stem from many plantation areas throughout the South and how they permeated themselves within, you know, the underpinnings of what would later be gospel music, which is obviously centered in Chicago and moved up from like the Mississippi region and the Delta. And so all of this is important because, as you say, like, you know, some people may, you know, look at the title and be like, what in the world is this dude saying? You know, Du Bois is not a Black social gospeler. And just disclaimer, as he previously said, just in case you missed it, Reverend Dr. Gary Dorian is not, I repeat, not making that particular claim. But you know, as you mentioned, he is someone that is he's very much involved with the politics that are involved with the Black social gospel. And I think, you know, you talk about Reverdy Ransom and
you know, can I just say there,
yeah,
Adam?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not just even the politics. I think there is a deep spiritual wellspring in Du Bois. It's arguably heterodox. I mean, you know, he's going to make up his own mind about what he thinks. You know, what his religious worldview is. And he was influenced by, you know, he studied under all these neo-Hegelian idealists, ethical idealists at Harvard. And he incorporated some of that worldview of Francis Peabody and William James and others that, you know, that he studied with there and had a similar kind of experience in Germany. So if you want to tease out some kind of an actual religious worldview that Du Bois, I think, is operating on, I think, you know, you could tease out a kind of neo or post-Hegelian sort of way of thinking about Christianity, where in which the key to history is a struggle for freedom. That's very, very akin to, and that's, you know, that is what Du Bois thinks. But what I would say about the issue that you are sort of pointing to, referencing, is it did it frustrated me for years that what literature we had about Du Bois, because you know, for a long time we had hardly anything. Just for so long we had that Broderick book and the Manning Marables early book, and that was about it for a long, long stretch. And then we got these, you know, magnificent books by David Levering Lewis. It just did tremendous work on Du Bois. But here again, I mean, the one thing about Lewis's take on Du Bois that just was frustrating is that even Lewis is just tone deaf to the religious idealism that is in Du Bois. He just has to, it isn't Christian in some way, in some doctrinal sense that Lewis thinks is normative, if you're going to, you know, call yourself Christian or religious even. And so there's a certain just not you know, acknowledging a certain kind of religious ethical wellspring that's in Du Bois that, you know, that church people in Du Bois's time got. I mean, these ministers I'm writing about, they certainly, it came through to them that this is someone who has religious feeling. He is religiously musical in a way that actually theologians tend to be, because theologians aren't people who just stick with a doctrine. You know, they're creative so far as thinking about doctrine, how they relate to the tradition. So that part of sort of Du Bois's work and just his being, I was seeking to sort of recover within this, you know, in placing him in this Black social gospel story, even though I'm quite emphatic that no, of course, he was not a Black social gospeler per se.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are all phenomenal points that goes to show that, you know, the spiritual nature of people is very much multidimensional. And that how people experience religion and how people experience, you know, the spirit, you know, or, you know, the Holy Ghost, as some folks say as well. It's, you know, even if it's not within the Christian tradition, you know, how people go about trying to gain freedom. As you said, you know, trying to free yourself and try to free the soul is a continuity that is millennia old. And so going back, you mentioned someone who I thought was an intriguing person in this book. And, you know, to the listeners out there, there are a lot of different figures in this book. Before, we talked about women like Ida B. Wells, men like Bishop Henry McNeil Turner and William J. Simmons and, you know, various other women. But there are folks like Reverdy Ransom and other men in here that are just tremendous. And Professor Dorian, if you may, would you be able to speak to someone like Reverdy Ransom and his importance to this tradition? Because I found his story pretty remarkable.
Reverdy Ransom is the quintessential founder. I mean, it's everything that, you know, it just, he epitomizes with this whole founding tradition is about. It's the Black social gospel at its best, at its most radical, relevant, inspiring. He's an early Christian socialist. He goes to Chicago early in his ministry in the church where Ida B. Wells was a member. He takes on Booker T. Just as, you know, Booker T. becomes famous, he is in an argument against Booker T. preceding Du Bois. I mean, this is still the time that at the end of the 19th century, when Du Bois is still playing it very carefully with regard to Booker T. Washington, not wanting to get on the wrong side of him. And, you know, Ransom is already taking on Booker T. from a prophetic liberationist Christian socialist standpoint, which is just takes for granted that we've got to build some kind of protest organization. He is stunningly eloquent. I mean, it's unbelievable that he was ever forgotten. You know, Du Bois himself said that, well, Ransom was just was so eloquent that his work will just live forever. That's what Du Bois said when Ransom died. That's how it seemed that it should have been. And yet, in fact, he was totally forgotten. He just went right down the memory hole. And you almost had to be AME for a very long time to have ever even heard the name. And his name doesn't come up even in books trying to track the ecumenical history of social Christianity and the like. He was just forgotten for so long. But it's quite amazing. Even from an institutional standpoint, I mean, just ignore the fact that he's such a brilliant writer and speaker. He's in every organization. I mean, it's not for lack of trying. Whatever is going on, there he is, in the Federal Council of Churches, in the NAACP, in the Niagara Movement, in whatever, in the memorials to the old abolitionists. I mean, he is just always trying to make something happen, and yet so there, you know, there he always is when you're trying to track this history. He ends up becoming the editor of the AME Church of the Church Review, so a national publication where he has a battle within the AME Church itself. He goes to Chicago, and the AME ministers get rid of him. You know, they boot him out because he's too radical for them, and he's kind of making them look bad, at least, you know, from their standpoint. So then he goes to Boston, and the same thing happens there. So it becomes nationally famous in both Chicago and in Boston as a founder and pioneer of the social gospel, and as a colleague, comrade of Du Bois's. And yet, you know, he's also a very good example of what we were talking about a little while ago about how this will get you in trouble, not just with the dominant culture, but, you know, with your own denomination who don't want to hear this particular way of, you know, of construing the faith. And he finally, he takes over the AME Church Review to say, well, we just need to make this argument in a large enough venue that we just can persuade more people, you know, that this is the way to go, which he does do. And one thing leads to another. And, you know, after 10 years of that, they elect him a bishop. So, you know, there's some success here to mark as well. I mean, Reverdy Ransom spent the latter part of his career as an AME bishop. And the same thing was true of Richard Wright Jr. So when you have Ransom and Wright both making bishop in the AME, that's, you know, that's the social gospel really getting somewhere within the AME tradition. So it's just, he's an extraordinary figure. And I would say, yes, represents that founding tradition at its best and in a line that does take you right straight to Martin Luther King.
Right. And I think that, you know, you mentioned, you know, how really their, you know, Reverdy Ransom's centrality to this tradition. And really, when you look at the 20th century and, you know, it is very interesting. It's always to me so interesting. The men and women whose stories are the ones that are, you know, really a part of the normative memory of, you know, the social protest tradition in Black life, and how by reading your book, I realized, like, good grief, you know. Ransom and you know, even learning about, you know, I went to an historical Black college, Florida A&M University, and, you know, you have, you know, the HBCU folks that we'll get into with your next work, you know, folks like Benjamin Mays and Mordecai Johnson and folks like them, where it's like, goodness gracious, I wish I would have grown up with these stories. But as many folks realize, like, it's not until you get older and you start reading books like yours with The New Abolition, where you realize, like, there are so many more people, right? And I bring this up all the time because I was an NPR kid. You know, Paul Harvey's voice is, you know, signposted into my memory of, you know, the rest of the story, right? Like, that very baritone voice. And so thinking about you know, that kind of ethic when it comes to the kind of work that we do, really the recovery work that you mentioned with Du Bois and his interactions with this tradition and Reverdy Ransom and others. That's why it's, to me, so remarkable to be able to interview folks like yourself so that people can have a better and more well-rounded understanding of the reason, you know, that folks like King come about, that they were people that he built on, that he didn't, you know, there's no immaculate conception in the story of how he gained his knowledge.
I mentioned a while ago that virtually all of them, with one exception, you know, had a battle with their own denomination and religious communities. The exception was Alexander Walters. And he's, there are a couple aspects of kind of the why of that. Firstly, he's AME Zion. And so that's a tradition that's actually trying to break into this story and has something of a competitive relationship with AME in parts of the South and the like. But you've got another sort of tradition here that isn't, you know, it's just different enough from the AME tradition that it plays out a bit differently. But more importantly, more relevantly probably in his case is that Alexander Walters is one of those special human beings. He is imbued. He has this kind of deep kind of beauty, a kind of winsome, compelling, lovely, deep spirituality that everybody recognizes. So even if you don't like what he's trying to drag you into, or what is if you don't like his politics or whatever, there's just no getting around. This is just a deeply good, kind, loving, you know, human being. People just cotton to him. And so because of that, because he radiated a kind of holiness that just made him, well, of a, you know, in a later time, he's a Howard Thurman type. I mean, that Thurman had a lot of these same qualities because he was like that. The road was smooth for him. I mean, people, he made bishop by the time he was 30. He's by the time he's 32, he's at the Mother Zion, you know, church in New York City. So far as the denominational context is concerned, he had a pretty smooth, road, but then, you know, to his immense credit. Yeah. Okay. He doesn't have a battle there. So he took on the battle in trying to build organizations. He headed the Afro-American Council during the struggling years when they're trying to get it off the ground and now trying to fight off Booker T and now trying to do a dance with Booker T to try to keep it together after Booker T tries to take it over. Later, teaming with Du Bois, saying he could be in the Niagara Movement, later NAACP. Walters took on an enormous amount of work in trying to build a protest organization. And so all the struggle, all the strife that he didn't get in his religious context, he got in his public political one.
Yeah, and I thought that was really, really a cool part about this work is that, you know, I was wholly and totally unaware of Alexander Walters and his work. But, you know, that's why this book is important, because it allows for folks like myself who have a great running interest, but not a deep reading of this particular tradition. And it's partially why when I saw your book, I think it was on Amazon or maybe even on Twitter. Twitter is usually where I find out about a lot of these books through conversations by others. But seeing your work and then going to Amazon and looking like, man, I need to get him on this channel. And then receiving the books. And so I thought that, you know, you mentioned his connection to someone like Howard Thurman. I thought that was pretty intriguing when you mentioned it, because being in Boston and also having the opportunity to work at the African Meeting House through the Boston the Boston campus of the Museum of African American History here, and his wife was someone who helped to really found Boston's Museum of African American History, And so also, if you're an African American at Boston University, you're going to know two people. You're going to know Howard Thurman and you're going to know Martin Luther King. And so, you know, I thought that connection was really cool, and how you made that Walters and Thurman had large connections, and, you know, in kind of how they went about their work.
Well, the kind of person they were. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I should say, you know, there is, so far as the socialist question is concerned, there is an explicitly socialist flank in the social gospel. I mean, by which I mean, you know, self-identifying, you know, just name it and claim it kind of socialism, maybe even belong to the Socialist Party kind of trajectory. So that's people like George Washington would be, and George Slater, and there are others in that line. Of course, Du Bois is in and out of that as well. The social gospel itself, more broadly, most of the social gospel is socialist in the sense of a kind of democratic, social democratic tradition. That is to say, that you're saying cooperatives are a good thing. If you could expand the cooperative sector and maybe nationalize what they called natural monopolies back then, that just those things alone, maybe put a single tax, you know, the value of land. Proposals of that sort were held very widespread in the social gospel on both sides, black church and white church sides. So in that, in the quite broad sense of the term, there's a lot of democratic socialism in this social gospel. But then there's always this flank, again, both on the white church and black church side, there's always a flank that's actually, you know, we're members of the Socialist Party, and making a big deal about saying we need to, you know, those who control the terms, amounts, and direction of credit have an enormous say in determining the kind of society that we all end up in. And so we need some kind of economic democracy that gets some kind of democratic control over economic institutions as well. Democracy isn't just a value in the political sphere. And that's a quintessential social gospel argument on both sides. In the book, George Washington Woodbe is the sort of the pillar of that, just because he's such an incredible figure. I mean, he just gives his whole life to this argument and writes books, and he's a spellbinder. He's even in the Wobblies, the IWW. He gets beaten up and hauled off to jail and takes beatings and comes back for more. And is just another one of these people who's just so heroically brave, you just almost can't believe it.
No, absolutely. And learning, you know, about the various figures in here and how they, you know, like you mentioned with that, to that last story, people putting their necks out there for this tradition. And I thought it was pretty interesting. And I think also something else that intrigued me too, you know, going on the notion of socialism, because, you know, in our country, you know, socialism has a, you know, it has a tattered relationship with the nation, though not literally, because, you know, what is public education? But then again, that's a whole nother, you know, there's a whole nother story for another podcast. But looking at how the usage of socialism in how, because I think that, because I'm trying to think about how to articulate it, as far as, you know, people today, when they think of socialism, and I ask this more for like the listeners who might not have a deep grounding in the Christian socialism that you're talking about, is there anything different, or what are the differences between the Christian socialism that you bring about when you talk about a couple of the figures in comparison to kind of maybe think about what most people think of their interpretation of what socialism is, and like I said, it's typically not in a good light, shall we say.
Right. Yeah. Well, firstly, the social gospel, it's called the social gospel in this country, was called Christian socialism in England, and Scotland, and in Germany, and elsewhere in Europe. And it usually has some kind of relationship to the the social democratic parties in Europe, always has that some kind of a close relationship. In England, of course, it's with the Labour Party. And these are traditions that go way back. I mean, in this country, we tend to think when we hear this word, we just tend to just think of state socialism, right? Which is the government nationalizes the major means of industrial production or whatever, however deep down it goes. And that's the sort of understanding we have of it. But of course, people coming who are in these Christian socialist movements and traditions know that, you know, that's the latecomer in socialism. The idea that socialism is government ownership, that is the latecomer in the whole history. I mean, for decades in England and elsewhere in Europe, and then to some degree then in this country as well, what they called Christian socialism, or what they ended up calling the social gospel here, is just it's a movement that at the economic level is promoting worker ownership, mixed forms of worker and community ownership, economic democracy, and the like. It's expanding the cooperative sector, and then that sort of leads to, okay, then what's the role of a federal government to make sure that, you know, that the whole thing works together? And it's only until the 1880s in England that the Fabian movement comes along and just basically says that that socialism really means government ownership. And that's the first time we really have a tradition that's just explicitly, just that's the operative idea of what it is. But of course, that idea became very influential. And then a generation later, once you have the Bolshevik overthrow in Russia, now we got yet another thing. And now we're not talking about the Second International. Now we're having a Third International, the Communist International. And that is just a form of kind of left-wing dictatorship, where it's not about democracy at all. It's all about a state power just sort of taking over and running everything. And that when that occurs, that's when it becomes almost hopelessly problematic in an American context to try to remember, dig out the fact that that's just not that business. The fear of communism is just not at all what people like Walter Rauschenbusch believed, or what people like Martin Luther King Jr. believed. Although what King, this was one of King's great regrets, is that he couldn't really talk about this explicitly because the whole communist thing had so polluted and perverted the whole thing that it was just too fearsome to be able to really speak.
Right.
To.
No, and that's 100% sure. And I'm sure in our follow-up interview, we'll get more in depth with that particular area. And so in the few minutes that we have left with you, can I, so one of the things that's new that I'm bringing to the interviews is that, especially as someone who's coming up in academia, as someone who's writing and just writers in general and people, who take in a lot of this work have questions about, the writing process if I can ask this, of you, would you be able to tell the listeners, what was the hardest, this is a two-pronged question. What was the hardest aspect about writing this book? But also, what was the most gratifying aspect about writing this book?
Well, I have felt this subject at such a deep level. And in some ways, it's this, my whole authorship was, driving in this direction to do this work. So to finally give myself to it was just the most, I didn't want it to end. Now that partly shows, these books are long, these are big books. So, now to flip it over, what's the hazard? It's precisely that as big as these books are, I'm only, hyper conscious of who didn't make, the last cut or the one before that, because I can't go on. I can't let this thing get any bigger than it already is. So making sort of quite sort of painful choices as to, who doesn't get in, because you got to make sure I've represented all four of these traditions and showed various things. I didn't just run. I mean, I could have made this much easier for myself if I had just done if I just defined it as narrowly as possible and then just run, you know, that line, that would have made it easier. But it also, that's not really what the social gospel was. It really was this many-sided thing. It wasn't just one thing, although it does end up lining out to something quite particular. So it's, you know, it's working the two sides of that, of living a subject that that then once I'm in it, I really don't want even the writing of it to end. But of course, you do need to bring it to a close, because otherwise these books just end up becoming impossibly long.
Oh, understood. Understood. And thank you for that, because like I said, there are sometimes, like I had on a previous episode that's going to publish soon, is I asked a scholar about how did, you know, when do you stop writing? You know, because I spoke with one of my advisors a few days ago, and how, you know, she's writing a book, and it's like, when you have so many other books that are being written as you are constructing your manuscript, it's like, dang, when do you just cut your ear off to the world and just say, all right, dude, I am writing this in hell or high water. It's going to get done, you know? And I think that's something that a lot of writers and a lot of historians and a lot of folks who are writing this kind of work, those are the kind of issues that they deal with. Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting. Typically I ask in our last question, what are you working on next? But then again, the next time we're going to hear you, that's actually going to be the answer to that question.
Oh, well, I suppose, of course, that book is out. I've got another one that's with Yale that's actually in production now. And then the one after that is almost done. So I've got, you know, two beyond what this next one's going to be.
Oh, wow. Would you be able to talk to us briefly about those works in progress?
Yes. Well, I have a big book with stuck with the same publisher, Yale, that's called Imagining Democratic Socialism, Political Theology, Marxism, and the Making of Social Democracy. So it's mostly focused on Germany and England. And there will be a second volume to that. And once I've sort of built this foundation of sort of what came out of the different sort of kinds of social democratic traditions and theorists and arguments and the like, including relations of religion to the socialist movements that are so different in those two contexts, that is Germany and England, that will be a kind of foundational work. And then after that, I'll end up writing a book that takes us up to the present day, and I'll bring the U.S. American context into it. And then I have another, the book I'm just finishing right now is called In a Post-Hegelian Spirit, because one side of my work deals with religious philosophy and philosophy of religion and historical theology. So there I'm making an argument about, you know, what there is in Hegel and different ways of reading Hegel that that are germane to me, and then what parts of the Hegelian, you know, worldview and argument are complete non-starters. There's an historical sort of component to that as well. So I'm nearly done with that book as well.
Well, we can tell by the four books that you've either published or in the process of publishing in the last couple of years, that you are someone that is very productive and who definitely puts the pen to the pad and gets things done. So that's definitely something that is something that, you know, a lot of us look up to as far as the productivity aspect goes. And I really, really appreciate you for sitting down with our listeners for the past hour and some change, because I really think that once people get their hands on this book, The New Abolition, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel, that people will really come away with a better understanding of how important, you know, a Christian religion in the Black social context has really greatly and positively influenced the nation that we both live in today. And I'm also very much excited to, once I finish your next book, you know, Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King and the Black Social Gospel, I am very much excited to read that, especially in light of Dr. King's 50th anniversary of his unfortunate assassination and all the great commemorations that have come out of that in the past week.
Yes. Well, thanks for asking, Adam. It's a delight to be with you.
All righty. And once again, we've had Gary Dorian from Union Theological Seminary and also Columbia University on with us today. And once again, thank you so much. And I am your host, Adam McNeil. Until next time, listeners.